Oh, there. I thought this was a cruel joke for a minute. My PowerPoints weren't coming up. And I'm not sure who I wronged, but I think I'm going to have to be especially tough on the men tonight. I think it was a guy controlling that, and we're talking about husbands and wives. And so, anyway, always glad to see my little wheels up here. That way I know I've got something to preach from, and that's helpful to me. But I'm really happy to be here tonight. Glad to have Kyle back and to get to see. I saw him in passing when he had a discussion in Nashville back a few years ago. It's the only time I'd ever crossed paths with him, and he did a great job in that discussion. And I told him so at the time and since then. But he demonstrated not only considerable ability, but the spirit that should take place in a discussion like that. And so I was very encouraged by that. No matter what other fruit comes out of that or not, I think that the spirit that prevailed was that which should be between people who say they follow Christ. And so thank you, brother. I'm going to talk with us tonight about husbands and wives, which means I have 10 pounds of sugar to put in a 5-pound bag, and you can do all the shaking you want, and it's going to run over. But I will have a lot of material. I will try to keep moving. Last year, in some meetings, I had some folks ask me to talk about home and family stuff, and I hadn't done that so much there at State Line, where I live. And so when I came back, I did, you know, several weeks on husbands and wives. But I'm just going to talk about some of those things tonight. And then the next two nights, I want to talk about parenting skills. You have a lot of beautiful families here. And I just want to talk about some things that are associated with that. And we live in challenging times, and they've always been challenging times. But we live in a time where there is a major orchestrated effort against all righteousness. And the family is one of those avenues in which the devil is trying to destroy the country and God's people. I feel very passionate about the family relation. And I didn't grow up as a Christian. When I became a Christian, I had a lot of baggage. Married my beautiful wife. We went to school together, and she had a little bit of baggage. I say, you know, she had a little handbag she carried into the relationship, and I had a hand truck. And so I had a lot of growing to do. But I do feel very passionately. We have 4 children, 22 grandchildren, as I mentioned, and I'm 68 years old and at a place in life where I love and appreciate the wisdom of God more than ever in my life. And that's not to say that our situation is perfect. We have one of our sons that's not quite where I would like him to be. Our daughter and other 2 sons, I could ask nothing more for them from them in this world. They are great spiritual people and great servants. But all of that is accredited to God. It's His will. It's His word. He is our designer. And His plan always works as it should if we all do what He asks us to do. And so tonight, as I talk with you about these things, I want you to understand I'm sitting down there. I'm not standing up here above you. I'm just a guy trying to hammer this out in life and trying to submit my will to the will of our fathers. As we think about the home, it is critically important. And I don't have a slide up here for this, but there is a fellow by the name of Will Durant who did a series of volumes about this, I think it's 11 volumes, if I remember right, the history of civilization. And one of the things that he says in there is a quote that I dearly like. Not that I couldn't get it from Britannica or someplace like that or Google, but this man spent his whole life studying civilizations, and he said that the home is the nucleus of civilization. That's simply a historical perspective, just watching the nuts and bolts of how history has unfolded. And I think it is no secret that communism and some of those associated philosophies, they undermine the home. They want to break down the home so that the government can control that. And who's really behind all that is the devil. It's not God. But what we need to understand is because the multitude, because the country in which we live, or because the world's doing certain things and they thumb their nose at God, God's not going to be mocked. And His will is absolutely true. And His word will do its work, as we talked about yesterday morning, in those who believe. If we want to play games with any aspect of this, then we're just going to get rotten fruit. But when we listen to God, it'll make a difference. And if you're in a situation where you have a mate that's not a faithful Christian, or as a lukewarm Christian or something. I'll just tell you from 1 Peter 3, that talks about a woman who has an unbelieving husband, but I think it applies to all relationships. That just means you've got to live it. You've got to live as a Christian, and no matter what situation that you find yourself in, you do what God would have you to do. That's the question. Anything that comes up, what would God have in this? When we talk about our homes, we all know this expression that a kingdom that's divided against itself will not stand, a home that is divided. And we need to understand that's true. And not only may it not stand, if it's sort of mediocre, it will not produce the kind of joyous fruit that God would have and that He has planned and engineered and provided. But God is good in all things. Well, as I said, I'm going to have to keep moving on. Old preachers have a terrible, terrible problem. I have a lot of things I want to talk about as we go down through here, but if I do, then I will fail. But as I said, I just want to pull back the curtain that we all have struggles in our marriages. I don't care if you come from a really good background, there are still challenges. When you try to mesh a man and a woman together under the same roof, there are some changes, some challenges that come. Some of them are very abrupt and difficult if we've got, you know, a lot of weaknesses ourselves. But what we want to do is help each other as husband and wife through those and build a relationship from which we can have an influence upon our children so that we will serve God and that they will be a heritage to the glory of God. I ran into a situation many years ago that impressed me. I saw some fellows that had stormed the beaches of Normandy together. They hadn't seen each other in a lot of years. And they came together and you could see they were old friends, that they were very close, that they had some deep ties. And that's because of what they had gone through, critical things they had gone through. It was not easy. And I want to suggest it so with marriage. That what happens as time passes is in a marriage you have your ups and downs and you have your challenges with each other and raising children and life and maybe unexpected things that came along the way. And as you weather those storms, it allows a kind of connection of roots of heart to come together that you don't get cheap. I'm not going there. But I think it's important for us to understand that. We just got to stay after it and do what we need to. Two imperfect people coming together, we're a work in progress, and sometimes people like to use that phrase as an excuse to be imperfect. That's not what we're after. The question is, am I making progress? It may not be as fast a progress as we would like, but am I making progress? And in the marriage relationship, certainly there are ups and downs. There are sometimes. We've been married, well, Lord willing, this June, 47 years. But we still have days that are easier than other days. That's welcome to life. But that's okay. I know she has goodwill towards me and I have towards her. And so we get through those in good shape. And most days are pretty sunny and rosy. But there have been some of them earlier in our marriage that were just a lot bumpier. But by the will of God, and we were both committed to do what God would have us to do, we were able to go forward with that. So I encourage you to give you hope. Sometimes you say, man, what have I done? Or what's going on here? Do what God would have you do. And you can go forward. You got two people that are willing to do that. You can go forward. As we think about the home structure itself, in Ephesians chapter 5 and in verse 22, there are several things here. And again, since I have several charts, I want to move forward. But in Ephesians chapter 5, it's a series of verses that many of us are familiar with. It talks about the relationship of Christ and the church. And in the course of that, we see from the beginning, God created the male and female. God joined a man and a woman, and His plan and His will was that would be a permanent relationship. That's what He wanted from the beginning. And we see, of course, in Genesis, that it was not good for man to be alone, and so God made him a helper suitable to meet his need. Not someone who is inferior, but someone who stands side by side, who is different, but a compatible partner. And when we figure that out, it's going to help us a lot. We're told not only in Ephesians, but in many other places about husbands that we're to love our wives, and wives are to submit themselves to their husbands, as you see in the middle of this chart. And I really like to use a particular point that I'll come to in my next chart about what it means that I'm the head of my home. I'm the Lord of my house. That's my role. I believe that's the biblical expression of my role, that I am to be, as the man, the Lord of my home. And in 1 Peter chapter 3, Sarah called Abraham Lord. But the question is, what does that mean? Not probably what I thought it meant when I first became a Christian. It doesn't mean that I'm this iron-fisted guy that gets his way and I call the shots and we're going to do this. And so as we keep going, and that wives are to submit to their husbands and to respect their husbands. Again, something else I had to correct my thinking. I sort of had the idea that I needed to make sure that my wife was in subjection. But as I look at all the New Testament passages, they all address the wife and they say, wife, you submit yourself to your husband. That's her responsibility. Now, I want to make it easy as I can on her. And I joke sometimes, tongue in cheek, because my wife has no problem with submission. She has no problems with subjection as long as I tell her exactly what she wants to hear. She tries very, very hard at doing that. I commend her for that. But the reality is we mutually have some responsibilities in this. And we each have wants and needs. I like to use an illustration that many of you have probably heard before. Long ago when the Model T was around, some old boys had a Model T and it was broke down alongside the road. And another old boy comes in a Model T and stopped. What's going on, boys? He said, well, the car won't run. And these younger fellows said, well, yeah, I don't know about this old fellow. He said, well, can I take a look at it? He said, well, I don't know what this old guy's going to know about it. So they pop the hood and they get down here and he tinkers with it. He says, let's try to fire it up. And it fires right up. And he said, man, how do you do that? I said, well, I'm Henry Ford. I designed this car. I know exactly what it takes. And when we understand that about marriage, it's not our philosophy, it's not our educational system, it's not our government who knows what we really need. It's our Creator. And when I can figure that out, even though sometimes things don't make real good sense, or I might say that's not fair right now, His will is always best. And if I will submit myself to it, I can go forward. The bottom line of Ephesians chapter 5 is that husbands, you love your wives, and wives, you show respect to your husbands. And I would suggest that I show her love in my speech, in my behavior, in my response to her, and she shows respect to me as her husband. And that doesn't mean with rolling the eyes and, now sometimes we do that. But at the bottom line, in the mutual relationship that we share is so critical. Now, the kind of a Lord that I believe that a man ought to be in his home is what I see in my Lord in John chapter 13. This is a situation where Jesus has tried to teach his disciples about being servant, and all they can think about, who's the boss here? Who's the big guy here? And so the night in which he's betrayed, they're discussing this. And he washes their feet here, says, you don't understand what I'm doing. So let's talk about that. I'm trying to show you, I came as a servant. You call me Lord, and that is exactly right. I am the Lord. But I came to serve. And men, I want to suggest that's my role in my home and your role in your home. The responsibility falls on you. You're the man, you're the Lord of your home as a servant. You're serving the well-being of your wife and your children and your home. And you're trying to make decisions that would honor God and do what He would have done in the midst of that. And as I love my wife, that will become evident. And as I love my children, that will become evident. That's an example of a real leader. The leadership of Jesus. The kind of lordship that I want to mimic my life after. Another thing, my wife is a very able lady, and I'm very thankful for that. And she's a very spirited lady, and I'm very thankful for that. But as we were married for a while, you know, sometimes there's this sort of a challenge, and this happens many times in marriage relationships. It becomes sort of a competition, is who's going to rule the roost, who's going to hold the reins, you know, who's the boss, who's right, and it becomes a competition. But that's not what God created us to be. He created us to complement each other. My wife perceives things, understands things, has insight to things that just sort of elude me. And I think it goes the other way as well. And so I asked the brethren at home, which is the best brain, a woman's brain or a man's brain? Of course, you get some interesting responses. And the answer to that is when they're both united together. That her brain and her thinking, she is different than I, and I than she. And when we are joined together, we have the greatest mind and the greatest brain and the greatest person that we can be by the design of God. And actually, after I spoke about this at back home, the next week I got thinking about it. Well, if I don't use my wife's brain like that, then I'm just really sort of a half-wit. So, anyway, but we're made to complement each other. And we struggle with that sometimes. And, you know, most of us are not going to fly a banner and say, yeah. But the reality is many of us struggle with that. But we can figure this out. It'll help us in a lot of ways. There are two major issues that come along up front here. The first is the fact that we have this problem of selfishness. And if you ask me to say, you know, what's the underlying problem in most marriage problems, it's just selfishness. Now, there are other things that people talk about, but it's about me. And we live in a world and a generation, and I believe that social engineering has promoted this powerfully. When I was young, I didn't even know what the word narcissist was. But it just means it's all about me. And you hear it everywhere now. It's selfishness. And I'll tell you what selfishness ultimately will do. It'll make you miserable because you don't always get your way. And so we struggle with that in our relationships. We need to count other better than ourselves at the bottom. A second major issue is that we just have to persist. We need to be patient. We need to be persistent in doing what is right. And as you can see on the chart, a couple of quotes here, success flourishes only in perseverance, ceaseless, restless perseverance. And Einstein said, it's not that I'm smarter, it's just that I stay with the problems longer. And so as we struggle in our marriage relationship, we just have to stay after it. We just have to keep saying, we're going to do what's right. And when we drop the ball, you know, we work it out with each other, we ask forgiveness of God and of each other, And we set out to do what God would have us to do. And sometimes that is a long, slow path. But it is the right path. And it is a path that will bear fruit in the course of time and will bring you blessing in this world and in the world to come and will help you to be a light in this world that is so broken. That's God's plan. So these two things are very, very important. Back in 2005, I was down in Central America and in Belize, and Pablo and Nelda wanted Ken and I to come into their home for lunch. And so we came, they just pressed us, and we went there, and she made the nicest plate of rice and black beans on there. It was really good. And you can see Pablo is in a wheelchair. About 20 years before that, he'd been around a logging truck that come unhitched, and logs rolled off. And they crushed him, and he is numb from here down. And she has had to watch after him and serve him for 20 years. He has no feeling. And we talked a little bit, Nelda and Ken and I, and sometimes it was difficult. But I said, you know, man, this meal is really good. And she said something like this. I want to cook good for Pablo so he will love me that much more. She has selflessly served him all those years. He was so limited in what he could do. And it was just such a powerful, humbling experience. I went out of there and told Ken, I don't deserve to be under this roof. And yet, I look at what we so often do in this country. Anytime I don't get my way, anytime something's inconvenient, I don't get to end up on top. And I look at an example like this and says, Gail, you can do better than that. And God would have me do better than that. And I'm trying to do better than that. About four things I think I've got on here. I hope I've got my charts lined out in that way. Is the matter of problem solving. There are always going to be problems that come up, and we have to try to figure out how to solve them. Again, our homes are under construction. Life and me as an individual and my family, we're trying to grow and go forward. There's some things that can help my marriage. I need to build bridges and not walls. Sometimes we have a struggle, and so we build walls instead of trying to build bridges and trying to solve the problems and make progress along the way. We need to spend time together. And I love the affluence that we have in this country. I heard a statistic of a friend of mine when he was preaching a few months back, found a calculator about how wealthy we actually are in this country. And in this calculator, it said if you made your household income is $65,000 after taxes, that you are richer than 92% of the people in the world. You are in the top 7% of the richest people in the world. I spend a lot of time in third world countries, so I can appreciate that. I'm thankful for my blessings and for the medical care and the good food, like I've been eating. But sometimes our pursuit of stuff kills us in other ways. We've got to have what the Joneses, that was the term used when I was growing up, keeping up with the Joneses. And these things can get in the way. Sometimes we get so busy chasing life that we forget to build a life, and we don't spend the time together with our mates. And by the way, I don't mean, well, I gave my wife my phone. I don't mean spending my time with my mate. She's over there, and I'm here with my nose and a cell phone or on a computer. I mean spending time with my mate or my children or they, us, when they were with us. Spending time together. I need to get my thinking on track, and I've got passages here that talk about our thinking as a man thinketh and so forth, and think on these things in Philippians chapter 4, but I must keep going. Now, we need to learn to touch appropriately, and I love this passage in Genesis 26:8 where it shows this kindness that the husband and wife had together. At the root of that, I understand the Hebrews laugh, and my brother here knows language. I don't know much about that, but that it shows the affection that's there. And when the king looked down on Isaac and his wife, she's not just your sister. But you could see the warmth and the tenderness and the laughter, if you would, in that relationship. And that's the friendship that we have. My wife is my best friend. And so when she hurts, I hurt. And if I hurt, she hurts. And you can throw all the stuff at me you want. You can have at me. That's going to hurt her. But if you want to get to me, you mess with my wife, because I care for her. You know what I'm talking about, husbands and wives. We care for our mates, and so it matters. And as we touch appropriately, we care. And I'll talk probably some in the next couple nights about raising children. You know, I'd walk by in the kitchen, I'd put my hand on her shoulder. I would give her a hug, or I may give her a kiss on the cheek. Again, I'm just telling her, you are important. I'm thinking about you. I care about you. I feel warmly towards you. That's why I'm doing that. And she, me. And I'm thankful for that. But these are helpful things in a marriage, and that we need to talk. And we'll speak about that some more in just a minute. That we need to respect and honor each other, as we just mentioned in Ephesians chapter 5. And let's face it, we all want that. We all want to have a level of respect. We all want to be honored. All of us do. And there's an appropriate level of that. But if I behave in a manner that's honorable and respectful, it sure makes it a lot easier. But in the relationship, that we need to show each other this. In many surveys that have been done in the past, one of the top 10 complaints in these surveys is too much screen time, too much computer, too much TV, too much phone time, and it's more pervasive and prevalent than ever. And so sometimes we just need to shut it off and lay it aside. We need to just say, okay, we're going to do something else. When problems come up, sometimes what happens is we want to fight each other. Sort of a fire breaks out between us. And a friend of mine used to say, you know, if you're in a room, the husband and wife are in this room, and there's no windows or doors over here, there's only a door over there, and a big fire all of a sudden breaks out in the middle of the room, what do you do? Start fighting each other? No, you fight the fire. And when we have friction and problems, We have fires between us. Instead of fighting each other, we need to fight the problem. We need to fight the fire. By the way, you know who builds the fires? It's not God. And it's not our better nature. So we need to look at those problems and try to solve them the way God would have them to be solved. We need to melt the ice. And I like this passage as we started in Ephesians chapter 5, but it talks about that the idea of nurturing and cherishing our wife as we would our own bodies. That word cherish is only used one other time over in 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 7. And there it talks about when Paul came to the Thessalonians that he treated them like a mother who's got this little nursing baby, the tenderness that's there. And so as we think about melting the ice, and what happens is we talk about relationships, they're not on fire like they used to be. They've gotten cool or cold or icy. And what we need to do is listen to the will of God and demonstrate love and goodwill and try to put the fires out that are consuming us and try to build the tender warmth that's supposed to be in the relationship. That is what God desired and wants. And there's so many forces working against that. In Proverbs 19:22, it says, "What is desirable in a man is his kindness." This definition of this word that's translated cherish or tenderly from W.E. Vine says it means to heat, to soften by heat, then to keep warm. As of birds covering their young with their feathers, Deuteronomy 22:6, in the Septuagint. Metaphorically, to cherish with a tender love, to foster with tender care, as of a nurse for her children. And so you see this idea of cherishing, this warmth in the relationship that's there. I'm going to tell you, sarcasm and a critical spirit crush the warm feelings in a relationship, whether it's the man with his wife being sarcastic or with his children or a wife to her husband and children. Such sarcasm, such a critical spirit destroys healthy relationships. And I grew up in that world. And so I've had to do a lot of changing and a lot of growing. And one of the things, my parents have both passed, and they're great people, but my father sort of grew up in that world, and he replicated what he learned. I said, I've got to stop this cycle. And that's what we have to do. We see things aren't what they need to be. We have to break the cycle of inappropriate thinking and behavior that we can go forward. But this matter of sarcasm and critical spirit crushes the relationship and the warmth and the friendship that's there. Any relationship, if you deal that way, it's not going to end up pleasant and good. Now, you might say, well, I've got some business to take care of, or I'm some kind of military commander, and we got to get this job done. Well, you may get the job done, but you may lose the war. That doesn't mean there's not time for constructive criticism or correction. That's not what I'm talking about. There are plenty of passages to talk about the appropriate nature of that. But what drives me in that is my love for my wife and my children and my family and my Lord. Communication is so critical. And as I said, man's brain and woman's brain is different. And I can remember early in our marriage, you know, I would talk to Deborah multiple times trying to express something like, man, there's no way I could say this clear. And she didn't get it. And come to find out, she was trying to tell me some other things at the same time in many different ways. And she was like, that's so clear. He's got to see it. But we didn't see it. It took some time. Our communication was not making its completion. I found it interesting. Back in 91 in the Persian Gulf War, General Schwarzkopf was interviewed. And a couple of interesting things. He says, well, they asked him, he said, you know, you were in that bunker down there. He said, what kind of defensive weapons do you have? So I had a sawed-off 12-gauge shotgun. that sort of caught my attention. Out of all the arsenal he had access to, he had a sawed-off shotgun. That's useful information. But as our troops went forward, the first thing that they attacked in Iraq was not the munitions. It was not the fuel depots. It was the communication centers. Because if you can destroy the ability for a group, an army, a nation to communicate, then you leave them hampered. You weaken them. You keep them from functioning as a unit. And that's so, brothers and sisters, men and women, old people and young people, that's so in our marriage relationships. We got to be able to talk. Now, sometimes ladies like to talk to get where they need to be, and sometimes a guy likes to say a few things to get where he needs to be. Sometimes we talk and communicate differently, but the communication needs to take place. And the idea of communication means to have in common. And so if I have a thought and a mind in my mind and a message and I want to put it with words, what I've got to do is talk in such a way that my thoughts become her thoughts. That's the completed communication. Sometimes I talk, sometimes she talks, and we think the communication is completed, but it hadn't been. But we need to maybe ask some questions and to be patient with each other. Sometimes we got to talk about it again till we get it sorted out. But communication is critical. You have a sender, receiver, and an understood a message associated with it. Many words, many actions, many gestures communicate a lot of things. I used to spend a lot of time in India from 1992 to 2000, and I stayed with a man by the name of Vijay Benson, a very good man. And his wife's name was Matilda, and I would stay in their home and come to love them very much. But was talking one day with Matilda, and she said, "You Americans, you waste so many words. Benson shows me that he loves me." Now, I'm not saying quit talking, but talk is cheap if it has no substance. And so I'll always remember that moment with Matilda. Sweet talk wastes words. Rather, he shows by action. In Proverbs 18:12 or 21, death and life are in the power of the tongue, and those who love it will eat its fruit. We communicate in many ways, and this is a picture of facial expressions, universal facial expressions, and there are many variations of this. And, you know, the face has certain positions and expressions that show sadness and happiness and surprise and anger, disgust and fear. There was a TV series that I think these pictures came from, was called Lie to Me, and this guy's supposed to be able to read people because he could read their expressions. But that was just a make-believe show. But this is reality. There's been lots of study about this, and we know it. Now, your word said that, but your face said this. Now, sometimes our face didn't say what they thought, so I understand that's true. But we need to understand that our facial expressions, they are also communicating. They are telling my partner or my children. They're telling others certain things. Some passages that I like that are just sort of helpful. Proverbs 15:1, a gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. James 1:19, be quick to hear, slow to speak, and slow to anger. Anybody besides me ever had a problem with that? Be slow to speak? Oh, I see a lot of hands up with those smiling faces. Many of us struggle with that. And by the way, the next thing it says in that text is the anger of man. Be slow to anger. The anger of man does not work the righteousness of God. That's of the earth. That's of the flesh. And so we have to be quick to hear, slow to speak, and slow to anger. Verse 20 says that other. Proverbs 18:13, he who gives an answer before he hears, it is folly and shame to him. Proverbs 13:3, the one who guards his mouth preserves his life. The one who opens wide his lips comes to ruin. Let no unwholesome word proceed from your mouth, but only such a word as is good for edification according to the need of the moment, so that it will give grace to those who hear. Now, Ephesians chapter 4 is a powerful passage in every situation, whether I'm talking to my wife, to my children, to my brethren, to my parents, whatever it might be. The things that I'm saying, is it for their good? Is it for their building up? Sometimes that may be a correction out of kindness and love. You're on the wrong road here, son. So you need to come over here. Or sweetheart. But the driving force is I'm trying to do good. It's not so I can vent. It's not so I can let everybody know how angry I am. It's not so... No, the kind of speech that needs to come from my mouth is called wholesome words. That's that's going to be profitable and edify and help and build. And they are powerful. Words are critically powerful. The third point I want to make in the midst of our sexually saturated society is the need to be intoxicated with your mate. And here we're talking about Proverbs chapter 5, verse 15 through 23. I use the New American Standard, and there is, it talks about a husband that is enthralled with his wife, and it's talking about the intimacy of the husband-wife relationship. And it's there a warning about adultery and having eyes for some other woman. God is watching, and he knows. But he says, let her fulfill your heart and your thought. Let her please you. But what it literally says is you be intoxicated with her. And the ESV has taken that from the footnote, which is the literal translation, I understand what's there, and they put it in the text, and that's right. I need to be exhilarated by my wife. I make that decision as a young man. I married her. I love her. My eyes aren't going to be on pornography. They're not going to be on the beautiful woman at Walmart or walking down the street or wherever it is. I need to be intoxicated with my wife. She's my wife. And then the next verses say, why be intoxicated by a strange woman? And so I think it's using very graphic terms to express the power of these basic human desires that God created as good and the devil twisted throughout the course of time, and to our baser desires. Do not neglect one another in this. Life is hard enough. And there is a whole world of people trying to grab men and women through the internet and television and other things to try to grab their money. Our young people, they're fishing, they're trolling for them. There's a book about pornography that was written probably 10 years ago. It's called The Drug of the New Millennium. And one of the things that it develops in there is how huge of a market that is, and how they are trolling for our young people. They're trying to send stuff out, even to innocently hook. And so as parents, we need to be mindful of that. In eating and drinking, in marriage, the intimacy of that relationship, there are rules for the bedroom, that you care for each other. In 1 Corinthians chapter 7, it says, because of the problem of sexual immorality or fornication, let each man have his own wife and each woman have her own husband. And you don't defraud each other, he says in the following verses. And you don't be apart from each other except by consent for a period of time, that you can give yourself to prayer and fasting, that you come together again, so that self-control doesn't fail in this. This is reality. This is a problem. It kills many people spiritually. And we don't talk about it much from the pulpit. But the world is crying in every direction, with our families and our children, and we need to understand our responsibility and our blessings in this. Quit worrying about pleasing yourself. Set your mind on pleasing your mate. Be intoxicated with their love. And as you think about what I just mentioned a moment ago, this matter of pornography, the temptations are there. Do not go there. Do not even start down that road. You find yourself starting. Get off that road. Stop it as soon as you can. There's all kinds of, I'll call it psychological interventions that where you're talking about various things. And one of the primary things you do in intervention is as soon as you realize you're starting to go down this road in your thinking and in your emotion, you've got to stop the fire while it's small. You stop those fires at the beginning so they don't become wildfires. Then you can't put them out with the whole fire department. It's a biblical principle, I think. And I'll not have time to go back and develop that, but I think the Old Testament demonstrates that. As we think about the relationship that we have, what often happens, there's no affection, there's no intimacy, which makes us colder and less affectionate, which just drives the wedge and compounds the problems that are there. It's called a downward spiral, oftentimes, as it's described. But we have a choice to do something about that, to change about that. And if we're not taking care of our husband and wife in the way that God would have us to, and always bear in mind that for the husband and wife, love prevails. My attitudes, I will only do good for my wife. I'll be looking for her care and she for mine. And so that may cause me to have to control myself at times and behave at times because there's difficult things. I'm just trying to be real frank here without being too plain. But we have a choice in what we do with this, and we can ask them to forgive us and repent and just try to go forward. And sometimes it may take some time to get where we need to be. That's really easy for me to talk about as I'm an old man. That's a good place to be. But I feel very passionate about this. I've got 3 sons, and I've got several grandsons. And I've got a lot of younger men that are like sons to me. And other, they're like grandsons to me. And this matter of pornography, I don't know if you have given much attention or to how prevalent it is. But it is not a trickle, it is a tsunami in this country for some years. And it affects all kinds of people. Enough said for that. Not really, but all we're going to say tonight. Marriage is worth it. It's worth the sacrifice. It's worth the time. It's worth going without certain things, denying yourself of some things. I'm going to use a silly illustration to you. I love to ride motorcycles. I've ridden motorcycles all my life, or most of my life. And I like to hop on my motorcycle and just take off across the country and just see the mountains. And my wife would be willing for me to do that if I so chose. But I don't have the time, a lot of things involved with that, and I would rather travel with her than be on that motorcycle. But what happens is sometimes there are things we may prefer, we may like, and we may just lay those aside for the good of our relationship. And she has been nothing but wonderful to me about anything that way. But I've tried not to take advantage of that, ever. But whatever it may be in life, I just use that because that's just a silly little thing for me. It is worth it. If I have to give up and sacrifice, if I have to swallow my pride a little bit, if I have to humble myself and admit my wrong and my sin, swallow my pride and do it. Ask God to forgive me and give me the strength to do what I should in relationship to my wife and my family, my brethren, whoever it may be. But as we talk about home and family, you just do what's right in the sight of God. That is always the right question. Anything that comes up, what would God have me to do at this moment? There's no loopholes in that. Well, point number 4, last basic chart. Well, what do I do, number 1, if I find myself drifting? You remember the Hebrew writer in chapter 2 talks about they had to need to pay more closer attention to the things that they'd heard. And so as I just extrapolate from that and talk about what if we find ourselves drifting? And maybe early in our lives we're busy with work and with our hobbies, with our self-interest, and middle life, all those things, and maybe some children. Later in life with the empty nest, you know, the things that we consider and our life, we find ourselves maybe have drifted apart, whatever. What do we do? Well, we'll just get busy and start building. And I've used an illustration for years that I really like, and I think it's applicable. In St. Louis, Missouri, there's a really fine zoo there. One of the fine things about it is it's a free entrance. But it is a great zoo, one of the better in the country. But as you go in the front gate, there's this great big map, and there's a red X, and it says, "You are here." That's how I look at life. And that's how I would challenge you to look at life. Well, wherever you're at, X marks the spot. Here's where you are tonight. The question is, young or old, where will you go from here? And so we find ourselves drifting. We just need to get over here where we need to be. We need to get busy building a relationship. What happens if you're in a situation where your mate doesn't seem to be responding? Well, I mentioned 1 Peter chapter 3. That's just a powerful text. You just keep living it. I think I mentioned Sunday a lady back in Illinois that just passed away, that her husband was not a Christian for lots and lots of years, and he made life difficult. When I baptized him afterwards, he said, "For 26 years, I put the hammer down on her." That was his word. But she said, "Lloyd, I love you, I will be submissive to you, but I first will submit myself to God. And that's what she did. And in due course, after 26 years, he obeyed the gospel. And he turned away from that. His son-in-law told me one time that where he had worked was Vulcan Materials, and there were some magazines of inappropriate things. And one of the fellows, hey, you need to take a look at this. And he said, I became a Christian. I quit doing that, and I'd encourage you to do the same. These are guys that he's worked close with for years. All of their children have obeyed the gospel. Their children's mates, most of their grandchildren, because this woman says, I'm going to love God and I'm going to do what's right. I'm going to live this. And I think that's true in every relationship, whether it's the wife to the man in this or the man who has a wife. I know examples of that. Whether we talk about the influence of children, whether we talk about other relationships, I think this is always critically true. There will be mountains to climb on the road of marriage. If you will do it together, the view is good from the top and even better from heaven. Now, I don't know what it's going to be like when I step over the valley of the shadow of death, step into eternity. I know if I'm in Christ, it's going to be great. I was riding with a man much more able than I am, older than I am, and since that time several years ago, his wife passed. We were just coming back from a lunch after a gospel meeting, and he said, Gail, I don't know how I'll be able to handle that in heaven with my wife. She's not my wife anymore. And, of course, I said, well, God will take care of all that. Of course, he knew that 100 times more about it. He's just reflecting. But I've just thought about that so many times. I'm not worried about anything like that. God will take care of that. It'll be okay. My problem is this minute, this day, what will I do? And I keep living it. And we'll talk about that in the next couple of days. And when I get to cross that bridge of eternity, then it'll be all right. And so I commend you to God and to His Word, which is to lead you to salvation. But I want to suggest it'll lead you to the best life you can have in this world. You want to know why you're here. You want to have purpose. You want to see good fruit in your life. God's way. We'll do that. The devil's lying out of both sides of his mouth trying to tell you something else. Go back to Genesis 3 and see how that worked and how that played out. But God is true. And in him there is no falsehood. He is not able to lie. That power is not in him. And he's given us instruction and a path that will take us to good ways and bless us. Thank you for listening so kindly. And just hope that the things that we've talked about tonight will be helpful in some way. Like I say, we could spend many weeks talking about this and other associated things. But this is, we live in a society that is upside down. You know that, and I know that. And it's easy for us to drift and to compromise. But we just need to go back and be what God would have us to be and love and serve like God would have us to. And it'll bless you. It'll bless you. And may God bless you and myself as we walk with Him. We have a problem, and that's our problem of sin. Thursday night, I want to talk about the gospel of Jesus Christ. If you have friends and neighbors that you would like to invite to the gospel meeting, especially to hear some fundamental things about our problem and about God's cure for that Thursday night, I hope to talk about that. But I want you to understand that you may be a really nice person. You may have grown up around religious people, but you've sinned. And the only way to be able to deal with that sin is God's way. And it was this great job, this great commission that Jesus gave, go into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature. He that believeth and is baptized will be saved. He that disbelieveth will be condemned. That's in a nutshell, Mark 16. The book of Acts tells about them going and preaching that. You can see how that unfolds. If you say, well, you know, I've got some questions about it, read the book of Acts. They'll fill in the blanks. It's clear. It's powerful. But if I've not obeyed the gospel of Christ, I'm still in my sin. And if I die still in my sin, I don't care how good of a neighbor, how sweet you are, how rich you are, how smart you are, if I die in my sin, I will be sent away from God forever. But God sent his son to the cross, and that's not what I want for you. I've got something better. And so we'll talk about that Thursday night. But tonight, if you are not in Christ, if you have not come to an understanding about Christ, reach out to somebody. You can reach out to about anybody in here, and I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll open our Bible, we'll put our finger on it, let you read what God said about your salvation. And then you'll know it's not from man. This is what God said. But if you believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of the living God and willing to repent, that means I'm going to change my mind about the way of living, my sin, I'm going to turn away from that, and I'm going to choose to set my mind to follow my Lord. And then confess him as the Son of God, making him my Lord and Master, and be baptized in water to have my sins removed. Why? Because God said so. That's it. That's the power. He is the provider of salvation, not me, not men. My Lord who died on the cross gave the message. And it is my Lord that died on the cross in Acts 17, 30 and 31 that I'll stand before in judgment. And he says, here's what a man or woman must do to have their sins forgiven. But that is not the end. In Matthew chapter 28, after the Great Commission is given in that text, all authority has been given to me in heaven and earth. Go make disciples of all the nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. Then in verse 20, teaching them to observe, that means to keep or to do, all that I've commanded you, and I'll be with you always to the end of the world or the end of the age. So once we start learning about Christ, we become disciples or followers, and we're baptized into Christ, we continue to follow, we continue to learn, we continue to. I'm committed to follow Christ wherever that goes. And it's a wonderful thing. If you've not responded to the kind, loving, gracious invitation of our Father in heaven, I'd encourage you to do so. If you don't understand, just reach out. We with thankfulness and joy and hopefully humility, we'll open God's Word and say, I'd just like you to read the mind of God. If you're saved, you come forward as we stand. And